Hey guys, we're back. Today we have an interview with Alex Berman. He is an expert in finding enterprise clients in the B2B industry. What's up, Alex?
Hey, thanks for having me, Tom.
Yeah, we were just talking about that a little bit, that Alex likes to break all the copywriting and advertising rules on his website, like everything that I'm looking at, which is cool, you know, because I do that too a lot. But it's like, I was reading one of the books recently, I think it was like Ogilvy on advertising, and for some reason I was just looking at your site now and I'm like, oh wow, according to him, like this doesn't work.
Well, I think so with a lot of the channels, if you follow all the rules, eventually it dies. So I've seen all these articles recently talking about how cold email is dead. And cold calling died as well the same way. But I think the only thing that's dead is all of the scripts that are in predictable revenue, or the only thing that's dead are the things that are online published. As long as you're willing to, you know, write your own rules or kind of do whatever you think works, I mean, you're always going to be in a good spot in that, with any channel.
I like that you mentioned that, you know, because what I've been thinking is that a lot of people pretty much roll off prospecting because it's too hard for them. You know, they're just not used to it. They're not used to the rejection. They're not used to going after clients. They think that everyone's going to just come and, you know, read their content or come from some kind of pull marketing or pay traffic. Like, you know, that they just don't have that skill in prospecting.
Even paid traffic is dying for the people that don't write engaging content. It's the same way. Like, with prospecting, they don't want to do the hard work of, one, niching down and finding exactly the type of person you want to talk to, and then writing customized messages to them. A lot of people take shortcuts. They'll send to like 2,000 people with an email that's not tested and not improved at all, and then they're surprised when they don't get any meetings.
Yeah, I've just had a conversation like this with this person, and he said, you know, I haven't been prospecting for 6 months. And I'm like, okay, so you're starting from scratch. He's like, yeah. And then he's, you know, trying to just do generic LinkedIn outreach. I'm like, well, okay, why are you doing this? Because the cold emails I'm sending out don't work. I'm like, okay, how did you send out the cold emails? He's like, I just scraped the list and sent him an email. I was like, oh, that's great. They must love that. I think it's just that it's a lost art, man. Like, people maybe just don't want to do the research. Maybe they haven't done it before in any capacity and they just feel like it's too hard. Let's just throw whatever we can and hope someone comes. I don't know. I don't know what it is.
Well, there's an evolution process too.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it seems like it could be easy. It's like, hey, I scraped a list of 40,000 people. Let me just email all these guys. But what I've found works instead is, let's take 40 emails off that list and email them and see if we can get 3 meetings from those 40. And if we can't, let's email the next 40, rewrite the email, try again. And it really is just kind of banging your head against the wall until you find it works. Then you can scale to the 40,000, you know, like then you can scale up, but make sure you have something that works first.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what's your testing process like? So what do you do with the initial 40 people? Because I just want to make sure that, you know, the listeners understand too. You're going after enterprise clients. So this
we specialize in the Fortune 500, Fortune 5000, billion-dollar brands. So these are household names: Home Depot, Creative Artists Agency, Starbucks. Like, these are amazing, huge companies that are very high value. They're not like, I don't reach out to local businesses or anything like that.
Yeah, so it's not the same as, you know, reaching out to the CEO, because you reach out to the CEO of Home Depot, you're not going to get anywhere. So what I would like to know is, when you're starting out, just so, you know, people can get a feel for it, what do you do with these 40 initial contacts? How do you find out who to contact, right? And what's the first typical message? And you know, I know it's going to be different with everyone, but just how do you warm them up? Like, what's the tactic?
Sure. So the first step, and I know this is, this sounds baseline, but it's, you got to find out, or you not even have, you have to decide what you're going to sell and then start from there. And it sounds like that's easy, because most of us, you know, even if you have a company, you think you know what you're selling. But for a cold email pitch, it has to be so specific. It's not just, hey, I sell video production services. It's, hey, I want to make a documentary about you. It's not, I build mobile apps. It's, hey, we just built a mobile app for Starbucks that optimizes their back-end, you know, production processes, and we want to do the same for you. It's getting that specific, and most of that is an internal decision, deciding what you actually want to pitch to the market.
Yeah, so we've spoke about this, and I try to knock that into people's heads a lot. You know, then what are you selling, who you're selling it to? You know, it gets super specific. It's one of the things that everyone skips, And it is the most important thing. So I think the listeners get that part. So let's move on. What do you do next?
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, once you have what you're selling, well, everything else falls into place. So let's say you are trying to sell some kind of back-end optimization software to consumer packaged goods companies or retail companies, like someone like a Starbucks. Now you know you need to talk to somebody that runs, you know, the back-end factory at a retail company or the back-end distribution at a retail company. So then it's doing some research on LinkedIn and trying to find what director level person does that. Usually that's LinkedIn, or it's looking at the website of the company. And you're trying to identify what title you're selling to. And from there, once you've landed on a title, usually I open up the LinkedIn of that person, that one specific person, and I write an email like I'm writing an email just to them. And normally what that looks like is a subject line. We'll talk more about subject lines once we talk about testing in a second, but you know, some kind of subject line. And then the email is a custom first line. So, hey, been following Starbucks for a while, really loved that, really loved the recent earnings call. You guys are crushing it, you know? And then the pitch. So we just built an app for McDonald's that helped them. We just built a front-end app for McDonald's that they installed in all of their locations and has increased their sales by 15%. Like whatever case study you have.
Yeah.
Would love to do similar for Starbucks. Are you around for a call this week? That's really how simple it is.
Right.
The key to it is that custom first line, because most people do not customize it. And there's a couple things I can talk about around it, but it's that, and then it's pitching something that they actually are going to perk up about. Like if you've just built an app for McDonald's and you're pitching Starbucks and it's improving something that Starbucks might get value out of, they're going to talk to you. You don't need to say you've been working 15 years in the industry. You don't need to say any of this other stuff.
No, it makes sense. Yeah, that's why I'm trying to figure out just how you handle that type of sale, right? Because it's different. It's different than, you know,
sure,
a CEO of a three-person business. You know, if you tell them you've built an app for their competitor, they probably won't even get the point. You know, it's a very different type of industry and job role. So that's why I like that. So can you give some more examples of the subject lines and mm-hmm. just that, yeah, like the variations? How do you test these? How do you make sure that the initial 40 can give you that feedback that you need?
So we're looking for two data points. One is the open rate and one is the meeting book rate, which is number of meetings booked per 40 emails. And we'll test subject line every 10 emails. And we do that by basically just riffing subject lines. So, hi from Alex, meeting next week with a question mark, company name / their company name, quick question, meeting Wednesday at 2 p.m. And basically every 10 emails, we're sending a different subject line to see if we can get our open rate over 80%. And I know that sounds super high, but that is very doable. And we have that for every single account that we work with, except for one that's still in the testing process. So it's very doable there. And what you do once you have that subject line over 80% is you try to optimize for meeting book. Meeting book rate starts with the responses. If you're getting a bunch of stop emailing me or unsubscribe or not interested, that means your email's coming off as way too spammy and you need to rewrite it in a more human, more targeted manner. If you're getting a lot of, you know, I work at the wrong department or somebody else handles this, then that means your target might be wrong. So then it's changing the target. If you're getting a lot of pushback from somebody, like, hey, I already handled this internally and we're good to go, that means you usually need to go higher up in the organization to sell whatever you have to sell. So it really is a process of constantly tweaking the email as you go.
Yeah, I think that's gold. Like what you mentioned right now, it's gold. Like if I was in that market right now, I would re-listen to that a few more times because that's key, right? That's just telling you exactly, you know, when one thing's not working, what to do next. Like I love that. What other insights have you got from selling to enterprise that's different from selling to smaller clients?
So what I really like about the enterprise is how many leads you can get out of one company. So for instance, let's say you're selling to like Procter & Gamble, or actually Johnson & Johnson, we book meetings with them. It's not just selling to one company like you would a local restaurant or whatever. Johnson & Johnson, you could sell an app to, you know, their toilet paper. Like you could sell an app to Bounty. You can sell a different app to, you know, whatever. Like every single one of their products has a different brand manager attached to it and a different budget attached to it. So it's once you get in with one of them, you can kind of spread throughout the organization. So I really like that. And the other side of that, same advice, is I love how they don't talk to each other either. So let's say you go in and you sell to one part of Procter & Gamble and you really mess up. You could still, in theory, sell to another part of Procter & Gamble, book a meeting, and have them never know that you worked with them before. So I really like that too. So it's not like you mess up with one Fortune 500 and you've ruined your reputation forever.
Yeah, I used to work for Nestle, and they were notorious for competing with each other. Like, our main competitor would be our own company for almost every product.
Yeah, and they hide data, right? Like, you didn't talk to anyone. No. Like, it's not open. Yeah.
No, like, we were always trying to undercut the other department because that was our biggest competition. Of course we're not going to share data. We don't even talk. We don't look at them. Like, they're the enemy. It was a weird thing, man, but what you're saying is exactly right. Like, those managers, like, they all want to beat out the other managers. They're not going to share anything. Like, if they're working with someone, they're like, this is mine. You know what I mean? It's like, they're not going to give that away. Unless
I like that. It's all. Oh, go ahead.
Unless you're just really good. Then if they want to just look better to the higher ups, they'll be like, and this is what I've done. And, you know, that's maybe when the secret leaks out.
Yeah, for sure.
Why did you get into the enterprise sales?
So that was my, you know why I got into enterprise sales? Because I wanted to be able to work for companies where, like, I would know their logos. Kind of like what you were doing with rap. Like, I kind of wanted fame, you know?
That makes sense,
But I started in New York when I first moved out there. I was doing cold calls to local businesses, so like karate studios, things like that. It was for a Groupon clone. A clone of Groupon. It was like Daily Deals. And I just didn't like how they all acted. I was offering something for free. It was like, hey, I'm going to list you on my platform and then we'll send you customers if they come through us. Like, it wasn't even, they had to pay for us. And still, like, the amount of people that yelled at me, the amount of people that hung up wasn't cool. And then I got a job as a junior sales guy at a digital agency in New York. And we were selling to these big name brands. And I mean, they're just so much more professional. Like, I'm not getting yelled at by these guys, except for a couple times at the agency when we did royally screw up. But it was like, it was so rare as to even, like, not even be mentioned. I don't know. I just like the professionalism of the large companies. Also, they're a lot more likely to buy because it's not their money, right? They, especially towards the end of the year, they have budget to burn and they'll hire anyone. You know, as long sometimes they need to spend their budget just to get it the next year.
Yeah, that's very counterintuitive, but I found that to work too, and I really love working with big companies as well. And it's one of these things you mentioned, because I used to sell door to door before, right? And I've done cold calling with the small companies, and you can see it, man. Like, especially in New York and Brooklyn and Queens and Harlem, like, man, I mean, they're tough, man. Like, they're like, just get the hell out of my store, you know? You're a sales guy. But the difference between an owner and a big company is a big company will have people whose sole job is to purchase things and to do research on it. So if you get, you know, to that person, like, their job is to figure out what you're doing. So it's a much easier conversation. And like you said, the budgets, you know, they'll have like, okay, we need to spend $300,000 on marketing this year. So it's a much easier thing than someone like, oh, I got to scrape $700 to pay for this SEO company. It's a very different approach. And yeah, I like that too. I'm just curious, you know, why you got into it, because I don't see as many people in this part of the business as you know, selling to the small guys.
Yeah. So when I was a junior sales guy in New York, it was me and four other more senior salespeople, and we were selling to these enterprise companies. And basically, we weren't getting enough leads. We were getting like 14 leads a month to split us all. I think my goal there was $750,000 a year in sales my first year. And so the only way to really grow it was to start generating leads myself. And, you know, from there, I posted in a bunch of directories. We started getting these leads. And I always like talking to the enterprise better. I think there's always a much bigger payoff for your time.
Yeah, it's so true. You know, we do a lot of course marketing at this company. And I love when I have someone saying, like, look, Tom, I got this problem. I'm making quite a bit of money, but I would like to scale and sell to big companies. I'm like, oh, thank you. You know, this is going to be much easier. Because now it's going to take the same effort, you know, to make one sale to one client or a company. But with the company, we can have 100 licenses. Or 1,000 licenses attached to that sale. So now you just made 100x whatever you would have made from the other sale. It took us the same amount of time, you know, same objections, same problems. Yes, it's a much different field, and I like
it. When I hit that 750 that first year, I think I sold like 8 things. So I don't think I sold that many things to hit that.
Yeah, because you don't need to sell a lot because it's bigger numbers, right? But, you know, I think you've seen that the amount of selling you're doing to each client is about the same if you've sold like a $1,000 product. It's just probably even less maybe because that the small business with a 1,000 is going to be much tougher to, you know, to spend that because they barely have any money than this big company. It was like, yeah, whatever, 100K, that's what everyone charges. Yeah, we'll go with you.
Yeah, and what I found is they're a lot more flexible on deposits too, so you can get them to pay a lot more upfront. They're a lot more flexible on longer-term contracts. You can lock them in for a year. Like I know at X27, our minimum now is a year. For our marketing services. And as vendors, not just from a money point of view, but as like, let's say we're running marketing for somebody or somebody's buying your mobile app or whatever, having a full year to fail and succeed and like try again and try different stuff is so valuable. And actually, I've found that it leads to a lot more success. Because if you're going month to month and you're so worried about getting fired every month, you're not going to innovate.
Yeah, that's true. Let's go into some of the negatives. Sure. That you can think of. So what should people look out for when selling to these enterprise clients? Because, you know, you did mention the budget thing at the end of the year. What other insights are, you know, can you give on the other side? Like, where have you messed up? Like, what to look out for?
Okay. So I'd say the main thing that sucks with the enterprise is how you constantly have to keep repitching. So, actually, there's two things around that same point. So constantly having to keep repitching, meaning you'll be halfway through a sales cycle with somebody and then they'll get fired and you got to start over again.
Right.
Or you're halfway through a sales cycle with somebody and then all of a sudden they'll add their boss in and you have to start again. And then that person will add their boss in. So picking the right person to pitch from the beginning is very important there. And then the other thing from working with these enterprise clients long term, it's almost the same thing where we've been hired at X27 for very large agencies that I'm not allowed to mention, but very large agencies where we got hired by one guy, he got fired a month in, and then we had a year-long contract. So now we had to, for a while, we had to push against the other client who didn't see value in what we offered because they didn't sign the contract. So there was like a 3-6 month process of us educating this person as they were paying us as to like what our value is. So there's just extra complications there when it's not just one person that you're dealing with.
Yeah, I think the hiring, firing is probably the most fun. What's a typical sales cycle for you?
So from initial contact to close, I used to say, and actually when I was selling like $100, $200 things, $200 a month, it was quick. It was like 2 weeks. But for 100K projects like we sell now, it's like 6 months, 3 to 6 months from contact to close. But it really depends on the industry. I know nonprofits go a lot slower. And some like funded startups usually go quicker. But yeah, I usually budget 6 months from initial contact to close. That's why it actually bummed me out what you were just saying about that sales guy getting into prospecting. Because even if he starts right now, it's like it's still going to be another 6 months before he sees any results. He might get meetings now, but, you know, it depends on how much his product is.
Yeah, the sad thing about him is that he can only sell to a very small niche of enterprises. Because it's translation work and it's mostly for German companies. So it's not only that he can't go after small business because they just don't need it. He's in a small market, huge companies with a long sales cycle, and he's pretty much starting from scratch now. So yeah, that's why, you know, when I listened to that, I was like, oh man, like there's not much I can say other than I wish you the best.
Well, I feel it too. So like when I was selling full-time before we got this team and everything, I would feel the months when I was lazy, but I wouldn't feel them right away. Like that was the biggest trick of sales. Like I would feel like I was crushing it for 2 months, but really I wasn't putting in any work. And then like the next month I would be out of leads and it would suck because I would be emailing super hard and just nothing would be happening. But it's because there was that 2 or 3 month lag from when I was lazy, like, you know, earlier in the year.
I think we all feel that, you know, and another thing which I always tell people to watch out for, because I used to work in insurance and it was just notorious in the insurance industry. You know, when you call someone and they tell you to call them back, those are not really leads, you know, because people would keep these leads saying like, I got a 500 callbacks. And I was like, go through them once, because you have this like this feeling that you have leads, but go through them one night and you realize like they're all bad. maybe like one or two will, you know, but all of these are garbage. Like, you don't have any leads. Callbacks are not leads. But I just found people, you know, being lazy because, like, oh, I got all these callbacks. I'll call them back in a month or two. You know, I'll get sales, no problem. Like, no, you're not. That's not how this works. You'll have to probably pitch them all over again and realize this is not a lead. And I've tested that theory myself. I've took a couple of these callbacks, right? I think maybe like 50 or 100, and I called them back when they told me to call them back. And most of them had no idea what I was talking about when I called back. Right. So, you know, but that takes experience. But I always say you gotta watch out for that. Can you take us through the typical sales cycle? Like what that would look like step by step with one client, just so we can see it.
Sure. So you're sending cold emails. You're doing everything we just talked about. You're sending cold emails. Let's say they get back, you know, you book an appointment Wednesday at 2 p.m. Usually there's some back and forth over email to find that exact appointment time. That first call, I treat it like a discovery call, meaning we have a list of questions that are there to gather data that we can put into a proposal. It's not really to sell them in that initial call. And what we're asking are things like, when we're selling our services, we're asking things like, who runs your marketing right now? What are your marketing goals for 2020? You know, whatever. What are your marketing goals for this year? What have you tried in the past and what's failed? Things like that that will give us insights. And the way that so we'll ask that question, they'll answer. So let's say it's something like, you know, what are your marketing goals for 2019? And they say, oh, we want to make $1 million in revenue, we want to make $1 million in revenue. And we'll ask something like, do you have a plan in place to hit that? They'll answer the plan. And then we'll say something like, oh, cool. With, you know, XYZ agency name, they also had a similar plan to hit $1 million a year. And they found out 3 months in that because of, you know, X, Y, and Z, it wasn't going to work out. And so what we did when we came in there was fix these three things, and you know, that really helped them. And so every single time that they answer us, we reply by adding value and giving a case study, and then we go to the next question. Okay. So it's a lot more of a casual, natural way to sell in that discovery call.
What happens then?
So after that discovery call, the sales guy's taken a bunch of notes. He puts it into after the discovery call, sales guy takes a bunch of notes, and then the end of that discovery call, we set a time for the next call, which is the proposal review. So he'll say, you know, he'll ask the closing question, hey, I would love to take all this data and put it into a proposal. How are you next Wednesday at 2 p.m. to go through it? Usually that calendar invite goes out that same hour, and they're booked in. So then they're in the next part of the cycle. Doing that, it's almost 100% in discovery call to proposal conversions, which is crazy. Okay. So then call two is going through the proposal. We go through step by step. We usually send the proposal out an hour or two before the call, not weeks before, not anything like that. The less time that somebody has to look at a proposal, we found the less likely they are to skip the second call and go away forever. Because when they get a proposal, what I've found, and actually we have research in our attachments, we track basically how if people open attachments, where they go. They'll look at the first page, and then they'll scroll all the way down. They'll look at the last page, which has the price on it, and then they'll never call you back again. Right. So we found that you need to be there on call number one to contextualize everything and to make sure that you guys are aligned for the entire project before you ask them to keep going. After that proposal call, there's a closing question there. The closing question is usually, all right, do you guys have any other questions? And then if they have other questions or they have other people that they want to bring on, then we'll set that call number three for, you know, whatever the next week. Like we're always setting the calendar invite for the next call on the previous call whenever possible. Let's say that goes really well and they don't have any other questions. Then the next step is a contract. So we say, hey, we're going to put a contract together. This sounds really great. Look forward to working together. How are you next week to go through the contract? Setting a time. Then we do a contract review call, which is just going through all the legalese that we have. And at the end of that, we say, hey, do you have any questions on the contract or do you need to take it back to your team? Feel free to redline it as much as you want. And then we book another call to review the contract. And that's the ideal process. The only way it changes is sometimes it might be three proposals or sometimes it might be like two contract calls or something like that. It can always stretch from there, but it's almost always that same process.
Got it. Very cool. Alex, how can people find you?
So our company is experiment27.com. If you want more enterprise clients. If you want free stuff, you can go over to b2bsalestraining.org. We have 22,000 subs on YouTube right now, and it's all just very tactical, free sales videos.
Awesome. Thanks again for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Before you go, let me know if you enjoyed this interview. Leave a review, subscribe, join the Smart Brand Marketing Facebook page, whatever is easiest. Also, if you need my help marketing your online course, or know that your business could use some SEO, come to smartbrandmarketing.com, check out the case studies, and reach out to me. Once again, smartbrandmarketing.com. Until next time.